I'm Cassandra Earle. You are listening to News and Views at RadioRegent.com, and this is your weekly news roundup. Beginning with international news, Wuhan, China is looking to test all 11 million residents for COVID-19, and they're on track to reaching that mark with 6.5 million people tested so far. The virus got its start in the Chinese city months ago. Thousands of medical and additional workers have been deployed across the city to conduct testing. These medical workers have visited construction sites, markets, and even made home visits for older residents or those with disabilities. This campaign is in an effort to prevent cases from surging again, which Chinese residents and news reports agreed has worked so far. The Chinese government is funding the initiative and sees this as a way to make residents feel comfortable about returning to work and reopening the economy. Some have criticized this move, stating it is a resource-heavy initiative and is not necessary when the numbers of cases are so low. By Tuesday, only roughly 200 cases were found where most people had no symptoms. However, the samples were still being tested at the time. Spain began 10 days of mourning on Tuesday to honor those who died across the country from COVID-19. Spain was one of the hardest-hit countries with over 27,000 deaths from the virus. At the peak of the virus in the country at the beginning of April, 950 people were dying per day. The country experienced severe lockdown measures where children couldn't leave their homes for weeks. The country is now dealing with the aftermath as hospitals try to repair and the economy struggles. People were wearing black face masks, Parliament halted for a minute on Wednesday, and flags flew at half-mast. This mourning period is the longest the country has seen since General Francisco Franco's dictatorship after the Civil War. The official mourning period will continue on until June 5th. Despite international travel being restricted across many countries, international and U.S. flights are still landing in Canadian airports. Beginning March 18th, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau barred all foreign nationals from entering Canada on international flights, with some exceptions that included emergency service providers, temporary foreign workers, and international students. This decision was made after many COVID-19 cases were seemingly connected to travel. According to Canada's Border Service Agency, last year during the week of May 11th to 17th, over 350,000 air travelers arrived in Canada from the U.S. This last year, there's been a 99% drop in flight numbers, with 10,845 arriving this year during the same time period. Since March 23rd, a total of 76,072 passengers have arrived in Canada from the U.S. Only four Canadian airports are currently accepting international flights: Montreal, Toronto, Calgary, and Vancouver. In more local news, last weekend, Trinity Bellwoods Park was packed with people enjoying the nice weather. It was so packed, however, that Toronto police estimate as many as 10,000 people visited the park when physical distancing orders are still in place. This is also following many calls from public health officials for residents to avoid large gatherings as cases of COVID-19 decline across the province. Premier Doug Ford said he was disappointed with the crowds at the park and urged those that were at the park last weekend to get tested for the virus. He also encouraged anyone that had been at any kind of large gathering over the weekend to get tested. Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders said several tickets were issued to people who were urinating on driveways and backyards of nearby homes, but few tickets were issued to those who failed to follow physical distancing. Mayor John Tory also visited the park on Saturday to educate those not following the rules, but a picture of him failing to wear his mask properly surfaced, and he too is now under fire. On Wednesday, Ontario saw for the second day in a row the number of new COVID-19 cases dropping below 300. 292 new cases were confirmed on Wednesday and 32 new deaths, which brings the total number of cases across the province to 2,155. 287 cases were confirmed on Tuesday, the day before. This milestone marks the continuing of a downward trend in the number of cases. So far in Ontario, there have been no deaths of anyone under the age of 18, and 8 of those who died were between 20 and 39. People 80 years or older are continuing to be the hardest hit, with 1,497 total deaths in Ontario. 847 people are currently being treated in hospital for COVID-19 in Ontario, and 150 of them are in intensive care. There have been 298 outbreaks in the province at long-term care homes and 136 at retirement homes. I'm Cassandra Earle, and you're listening to Radio Regent at RadioRegent.com.
The magnitude of the COVID-19 crisis is unprecedented, and it's having a profound effect on the health, social, and economic activities of Canadians. In our segment today, we are going to talk about the impact of COVID, and we will meet the founder of Progressholic, a platform to highlight initiatives that help out with the negative effects of COVID-19 pandemic to provide a platform to raise awareness about these initiatives. But first, let's talk about some of the current and potential impacts of COVID-19. Recently, Statistics Canada developed a new initiative to generate data and analysis quickly and effectively via crowdsourcing, and Canadians have responded. From April 3rd to 9, 2020, close to 200,000 people visited Statistics Canada's website and took part in an online questionnaire about how COVID-19 is affecting their lives. Here are some of the interesting results. Close to 6 to 10 people aged 65 and older, close to 6 in 10 people aged 65 and older reported that they were very or extremely concerned about their own health. Participants aged 15 to 24 were more likely to report that they were very or extremely concerned about the stress from confinement at home. That was 41%, a concern that was also shared by 40% of adults aged 35 to 44 who are more likely to be living with young children. Frighteningly, young women aged 15 to 24, however, were significantly more likely to report that they were very or extremely anxious about the possibility of violence in the home. That was at 12%. Specifically, close to one half of the participants aged 15 to 24 reported that the COVID-19 pandemic would have a moderate or major impact on their ability to meet their financial obligations. The COVID-19 pandemic has also changed Canadians from their spending habits to the food they eat and the clothes they wear. And according to Leger, one of Canada's largest research and analytics companies, the post-pandemic world may look a lot different. Leger polled more than 3,000 Canadians. Here are some of their findings as reported by CTV Winnipeg on May 2nd, 2020. 8% of Canadians began purchasing online for the first time in their lives during the pandemic. The increase is going to have an impact on how people purchase items going forward, and smaller independent local stores will need to increase their online presence to survive. The move to online has gone beyond purchasing as well. There has also been an emerging e-learning trend. 25% of Canadians have done some sort of learning course or tutorial online. For a lot of Canadians, Leger says e-learning is becoming a part of their lifestyle. They also report that working from home is here to stay. Close to 50% of Canadians surveyed said they are working from home now because of the crisis. And close to 80% said that they were satisfied working from home. This shift to home office will have far-reaching effects on Canada's economy. Leger predicts that within a year or two, many office buildings will be downsizing to accommodate the shift to home-based workers. Even apparel stores will have to make decisions about how much business clothing they carry, as less people are required to dress up to go to work. Leger said, as life begins to return to normal, the amount of spending on non-essential items may decline, as their study showed a growing attitude among Canadians. There's a growing attitude among Canadians that it's cool to be cheap. According to Leger, 32% of Canadians served will reduce their spending on what they consider non-essential products and service. There will be a change in saving strategy with more focus on savings. The pandemic has changed the way people grocery shop and they're moving away from prepackaged food. People are going back to staple products, a move towards make it yourself. The pandemic has brought travel to a standstill with restrictions in place on international and domestic travel. Leger said more than 50% of Canadians surveyed said they have either had to cancel or change their vacation plans in 2020. This is where the staycation will probably become the norm for 2020. This is all blended with having the second highest rate of joblessness in Canadian history. And I have not even touched on the impacts on Canadian economy, education, healthcare, and long-term care. Then there are the immediate impacts. As of 7:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday, this past Tuesday, Canada had 86,647 confirmed and presumptive coronavirus cases, with 45,352 of those considered recovered or resolved. The CBC News tally of deaths based on provincial data, regional health information, and CBC's reporting stood at 6,735. The changes we are facing now are going to be profound, yet there's not a lot of media platforms that are dedicated to talking about current and long-term impacts of COVID, as well as initiatives to help out with the negative effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Today on News and Views, to talk about an online platform that focuses on initiatives that help out with the negative effects of COVID-19 pandemic, we are pleased to have with us Devis Tilokani. Devis Tilokani is a podcaster and founder of Progressholic, an online platform where stories of individuals dedicated to the progress of self and society are highlighted to educate online participants on creating impact within themselves and the communities they operate in. With the COVID-19 pandemic, Devis decided to shift the focus of Progressholic to initiatives that are helping out with the negative effects of the COVID-19 pandemic and to provide these initiatives with a platform to raise awareness about the issues they are addressing and the work they are doing. Before we begin, let me tell you a little about Devis. Devis is a 21-year-old university student currently completing his undergraduate program at the Ivy Business School while running Progressholic. Devis has a passion for social impact and working on trying to solve some of the problems faced by the communities that we operate in.
A podcaster and founder of the website Progressholic. You're listening to Radio Regent at RadioRegent.com. Here's Taha Hashmani and Massey Kay to talk about issues facing the homeless in Toronto during the COVID-19 crisis.
I'm standing in the park at area of the Sanctuary Toronto, just walking through here right now. Very busy, looks like a giant campground. All the entrances to the building are pretty much packed. There's people pretty much everywhere. And at the back yard, it's called the Sanctuary.
Welcome back to Radio Regent. This week we look at a lawsuit that was filed against the city last month in response to what many advocacy groups say are deplorable conditions facing those in the shelter system. I had the pleasure to speak with spokespersons from two of the advocacy groups involved in filing the lawsuit, while Massey checked out some of the encampments that have now popped up in and across the city of Toronto. Before we head there, however, here's a quick summary of the statement by the City of Toronto in response to the settlement to the lawsuit that was filed last month.
On May 19th, 2020, the City of Toronto released a statement regarding the settlement with the groups that were suing them. The statement's headline regarded continued physical distancing measures in the city's shelter system. It says that the city reached an agreement with respect to a motion for injunction, a proposal for a judicial order or warning that would hinder the city's response as a result of it mishandling a situation in the past. The statement said the injunction regarded the city's unprecedented response to protect those experiencing homelessness in Toronto. This unprecedented aspect is a large theme in the statement, which mentions the fact that this is the first time in history the city declared an emergency in this way, and that Toronto has never experienced something on this scale. The statement also says that the city is pleased to reach a settlement so it can continue to focus its efforts on responding to the health needs of its most vulnerable residents. Although the settlement is a result of the city being sued for horrendous conditions, the statement says that the settlement confirms the city's commitment to safety within these shelter systems. This commitment upholds the terms of the settlement: better physical distancing within shelters and respite areas. This includes 2 meters of separation between beds, as well as stopping the use of upper bunk beds. Continuing with the sentiment of unprecedented situations and the city's commitment, the statement listed the city's accomplishments prior to the conflict that led to the settlement. The specific accomplishments listed are those that took place in April, when the city acquired and built transitional housing, including hotels, 125 apartments in Midtown Toronto, and a 200-bed facility for those who are homeless and have contracted COVID-19. April, although, was a time that the city was in the spotlight for these helpful actions, a month before it landed in hot water, with the lawsuit claiming that the city was not doing enough within the shelters themselves to protect people from COVID-19. The settlement perhaps marks another accomplishment for Toronto as a whole to improve its response. But the lawsuit itself, after the city seemed to be handling the shelter response situation well, is a reminder that there is always more work to be done.
Now, the lawsuit in question had various elements that the advocacy groups wanted to bring to light. These ranged from crammed shelter space to residents sleeping in beds without respecting proper social distancing guidelines. The advocacy groups that filed the lawsuit included the Advocacy Center for Tenants Ontario, the Black Legal Action Center, the HIV and AIDS Legal Clinic Ontario, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, the Aboriginal Legal Services, and Sanctuary Toronto.
My first name is Kathleen, and my last name is Smith. I do outreach work, and I'm also a media spokesperson for Sanctuary. Sanctuary is a community and a church. So we are a community that particularly values people who are poor and marginalized. So we offer an opportunity for people to come and develop healthy relationships. We also offer a lot of resources. So we, under ordinary circumstances, we have community meals where people can get food, but they can also access showers, toiletries, healthcare, Wi-Fi, and phones. We have creative arts programming. We have programming specifically for women who are on the street or who are marginalized. And we also do street outreach, reaching out to people, particularly in the downtown east side, offering connection as well as essential supplies, winter gear, water, socks, that kind of thing. So during COVID, we have been running 4 drop-ins a week. They've all been drop-ins where we have offered meals. Most of those meals end up getting served outside. People will, their meals are prepared in-house in our kitchen facilities and then put into takeout containers, and people can grab them from the outside so that we can practice social distancing. But on a limited basis, we are allowing people to come inside to eat if they want to, but also to access our shower facilities, to use our Wi-Fi, to use the phone, and to access medical care. So we're allowing 5 people at a time in our downstairs space to do that. We also have a space upstairs that we are allowing up to 5 people at a time to come and rest or nap during our drop-in hours.
Now, Sanctuary is just one of many organizations that have stepped up to help those most vulnerable and susceptible to COVID-19.
When the physical distancing measures and sort of closures happened right at the start of all this, it was the impact, I would say, was really, really severe on, I think, anybody who is poor or marginalized, but particularly people without housing. What happened was that almost all of the drop-ins in the city, so places like us that, you know, have their doors open for people to access food and other resources, almost all of them closed at the outset of this just because they didn't have the resources to offer, to operate under the requirements of the pandemic. So whether that meant they didn't have enough cleaning materials or they didn't have enough PPE. The other thing that happened is that all the kinds of public spaces that people without housing usually use to just be in, to spend time in, or also to access essential resources like the bathroom, those all closed too. So people had nowhere to go. They had nowhere to get food. They had nowhere to use the washroom. A lot of people in our community also rely on panhandling to either their entire income or to supplement their social assistance income. And that source of income completely dried up because nobody's going outside. And also most places aren't accepting cash anymore. So even if they were able to get some money from panhandling, there's almost nowhere that they could actually spend it. The other thing that happened that had a really huge impact is that their social distancing measures. Some shelters tried to implement some social distancing measures, and the outcome of that was that there were fewer spaces than ever before. And it was really, really common for people to want to access shelter spaces and for there to be none in the city before this happened. That situation became even worse. But at the same time, the social distancing measures that were put in place in city-run shelters and respites were not adequate. They were not meeting public health recommendations, CDC guidelines, anything like that. And so even if we could get someone a shelter space, we really had no confidence that once they got there, there were going to be adequate measures in place, like physical distancing measures, personal protective equipment, anything like that, to actually keep them safe once they got there. Right at the outset of this, representatives from Sanctuary and lots of advocates from across many different organizations were calling for hotels to be made available for people without housing so that they could properly socially distance. You have your own room, your own bathroom. It makes sense. There are, you know, thousands of hotel rooms in the city sitting vacant right now because nobody is doing business travel or leisure travel. That happened very, very, very slowly and in a really limited basis. So I don't actually have the exact numbers in front of me of the numbers, but basically where we needed to get thousands of people into hotels, weeks into this, there were maybe a couple hundred, maybe 400 people in hotels, but many more were still in shelters. The other thing that the city that was really slow about was actually implementing social distancing, physical distancing in shelters. In fact, they still haven't reached 100% compliance based on their most recent report. They're working towards it because they've committed to it because of the settlement in the lawsuit, but they still haven't reached full adequate physical distancing in the shelter system. We were recognizing the really dire situation on the ground that I've described to you where people had nowhere safe to go, which is unacceptable, and people in encampment spaces were being cleared and provided with no good alternatives, and there was really no transparency from the city or accountability about how this situation was going to be resolved. They sort of continually told us and other advocates that they were working hard, working day and night to find a solution, but at the same time, there were still hundreds, maybe even, you know, thousands of people either in unsafe congregate settings in shelters or still on the street. So it reached a point where we couldn't wait anymore for this, we couldn't trust the city to take these actions in a timely way, in a way that was going to save lives on their own. I mean, in the delays have resulted in 2 deaths from COVID-19 in the shelter system and over 300 COVID-19 infections from outbreaks within the shelter system.
My colleague and I, we came across different stories about tents being put up as temporary shelter.
Yeah.
Is that something the city planned to do, or was that kind of like a spur of the moment decision?
No, so the city had nothing to do with that, and they've actually been really opposed to it. So the tents going up have been, many of the tents have been provided by Sanctuary and other organizations like us who have recognized that, I mean, obviously a tent is not an ideal shelter for someone. There's all kinds of risks associated with staying outside in the tent in the city. But right now, it's the best option for many people because they don't have a home and the shelters aren't safe. And there isn't space.
walking around, just about to ask somebody for an interview, and some guy pointed out some two dudes with a camera and suits interviewing people, pointing cameras, and say, hey, those guys are interviewing us. And so it didn't really, you know, feel the safest to be, you know, walking around standing right there when people, they don't really seem very too friendly. You know, the people recording them and stuff. Mm-hmm. One the guy that I talked to, he didn't want to be identified, what was his real name, he wants to speak off the record and didn't want to be recorded. So I'll just refer to him as V. V said that it's actually not that bad around there right now at Sanctuary Toronto, because what he said is, quote, the streets figure itself out. He was worried about the shelter system. He said the government needs to make a lot of changes to the shelter system, saying that people get robbed. People, you know, get their stuff stolen, you're going to get your stuff stolen inside the system. But he said it's nicer out there because, you know, the streets figure itself out. There's no, you know, nobody really watching over me and stuff like that. And there really wasn't. I mean, there were people walking by. Nobody was, you know, giving mean stares or anything. And I wasn't there for a long time, but it doesn't seem completely unsafe. He says that inside of the shelter system is broken, but he said the parkette, outside of Sanctuary Toronto, outside the system, and that he thinks that it's working a little bit better.
My name is Nana Yaffel, and I am one of the staff lawyers and the legal team lead at the Black Legal Action Center. The Black Legal Action Center is part of the coalition. There are a few other organizations, so the HIV and AIDS Legal Clinic of Ontario, the Advocacy Center for Tenants Ontario, Sanctuary Ministries of Toronto, Aboriginal Legal Services, Canadian Civil Liberties, and our coalition was represented by two law firms, so by Golbat Partners and Munster Slut, and we got involved because of the issues that I was saying before. We recognize that our community is overrepresented in the homeless population. Our community, you know, has a disparate reliance on the shelter system, so, you know, as a result of the legacy that I mentioned of anti-Black racism. And so we knew that when we heard about this potential litigation, we knew that we had to get involved because there were just so many questions that remained, right? Like, we already know about the housing crisis. We know that, you know, I think the number is like over 100,000 people in Toronto are on a wait list for affordable housing. Like, people have to wait a decade for an apartment, right? If there's no affordable housing plan in place at a national level, and we know that we're overrepresented in the housing system, COVID is going to disproportionately affect us, right? So we also were hearing mixed things that, hey, the city has 1,000 hotel rooms available to move people out to make sure they're socially distancing, but they're not, or physically distancing, but they're not doing that. So there were just there was a lack of transparency and clarity from the city level as to what was being done, why it was taking so long to fill these potentially empty rooms and to accommodate physical distancing standards. So we got involved with the coalition, and we filed like a demand letter. So we warned legal action against the city, I think end of April, like April 21st. And we said, listen, City of Toronto, you have to immediately create appropriate physical distancing standards. They didn't do that. So then on April 24th, we filed our constitutional and human rights challenge against the city. We later included the province, and we said, hey, you are failing to urgently protect the lives of those experiencing homelessness during COVID-19. We, for Black, we were saying, listen, we are concerned that currently as it stands, like currently how the shelter system operates in Toronto, under the Toronto shelter standards, under the 24-hour respite site standards, that the current standards are inconsistent with what public health is telling us we should do in order to maintain physical distancing, right? So we were saying, under these current standards, they're inconsistent with particular rights under the Charter of Rights and Freedom and under the Ontario Human Rights Code. So, for example, the rights under Section 7, so your right to life, liberty, and security of the person, and then also under Section 15, which is like equality rights. And we're saying, listen, the way that it's operating right now is inconsistent. And that inconsistency, the government can't show that it's justified under Section 1 of the Charter, right? So you have to go through that the argument and show the way that they're doing things right now is actually impeding the rights of the homeless population. And then how we argued around Section 15 in terms of equality is saying, hey, this is actually disproportionately affecting Black and Indigenous folks because we are overrepresented in the shelter system, mm-hmm. right? So we were asking the city to, you have to immediately stop operating in these ways under these two standards during the period of this emergency and COVID. You have to require, we are requiring that you have at least 2 meters, right, distance between the beds, and we are saying you cannot be using bunk beds, right, because under the current shelter standard, respite standards, they were permitted and encouraged to actually use bunk beds, right, to fit more people in. And we're saying, actually, no, you need to have 2 meters in between beds, and you cannot use bunk beds. What's really key about this agreement is that the city is now required to provide regular, detailed reports about its ongoing efforts, right, and the progress. And they have to keep doing that and sustaining that. And as a coalition, we're going to keep a watch on that and make sure. And the city has to regularly report on its progress until it reaches and until it sustains that compliance for at least 2 months, right? So we have a good chunk of time to observe how the city is doing it and whether or not they're complying with the terms of the agreement.
Nana mentioned that many residents of the city's shelter system have set up tents and encampments as a means to stay safe from the dangers of the shelter system, especially with the increased risk of contracting the COVID virus due to overpopulation in the system and a lack of adequate social distancing. So before we cap it off, I think a lot of our listeners would like to know how people out there are surviving or managing during this pandemic. For you personally, how are you dealing with all of this?
Really? They want to know the truth or the social media thing? No, I'm just joking. I feel incredibly fortunate. One thing that this has really shown is, you know, as much as I think our society likes to complain about, like, oh, this is so hard, it's showing me how blessed I am and, you know, just how lucky I am that I have a job that I can do remotely. I don't have to go into the front lines and put myself at risk every single day and, be more exposed to potential police presence. Like, I guess there's just so many things that I'm really super grateful for. I have a great family. I have a son and he like brings so much joy to my life. And even though it's challenging to work from home with a toddler, you know, he's really showing me just how much there is to be grateful for. So I'm definitely managing and I'm really, really grateful for good health and work, stable income, and that I get to do work like this. I really am so blessed to be working at the Black Legal Action Center.
That was a report from Talha Hashmani and Massey Kay on issues facing the homeless in Toronto.